League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Hey, everybody. On today's episode, I will be talking with Greg Doxakis. Greg Doxakis. Doxakis. One more time. Hi, everybody. On today's episode of Whiskey Neat, we will be talking with the Texas State Manager for Maison Ferrand, Greg Dox, and my buddy, both my buddies. Sorry, that was insulting. Pasha Morchetti. This is just not my day. Greg Dox and Pasha Morchetti, the owner and operator of Rosewater, one of Houston's premier, I'll say, bars, because you guys do everything from cocktails to whiskey to cognacs to everything.
Sure. We have great water also.
Great water. And today's episode is sponsored by Woodford Reserve and the Houston Whiskey Social. Visit www.houstonwhiskeysocial.com for your tickets to this July event, July 28th, a Saturday, where we feature more than 300 whiskeys from around the world, including Pappy Van Winkle and the Buffalo Trace Antique Collection, the highly coveted. You will not find it at any other event in Texas.
And one cognac.
And one cognac.
And the lines will be shorter for those.
So and the lines will be a lot shorter for everything. So
no, I mean, it's good because they're delicious and you can taste them.
www.houstonwhiskeysocial.com. All right. Where do you want to start? As far as pouring something.
Where do you want to start? You tell me.
Yeah, this is your show.
So we're, now, I don't know if you tried all those. You may have tried the... You remind me which ones you tried. I think you may have tried that.
I think I tried two, but I don't remember trying any of these.
You want to go low proof first?
Yeah, let's go lower proof first. Let's go 46.2. Or is there enough left in here to do that?
Go ahead. Yeah, that's a 2009 Trinidad.
We're killing babies.
Oh, my God. Dude. And by the way, these, what is this, 50 or 100 mils? Oh, it's 100 mils. Yeah. It's awesome.
Those are just sampler bottles from the actual distillery.
Sweet. You want to try some of that? Have you tried this already?
This morning, not yet.
Yeah. Trinidad with white peanut. Of course, the double maturation with Pierre Ferrand cognac barrels as all plantation, but also going to spend some time in white Pinot de Chiron barrels.
Sweet.
Trinidad, dry and savory, and this one really fruits it up a little bit. That Pinot Cask
super French, yeah. Super fruity.
It's definitely the first drink of the morning.
Yeah. Oh man, and it's candy.
It is, but there's still an underlying like alcoholic structure to it that keeps it interesting. I wouldn't call it syrupy sweet.
I'd say it's my initial thought was a little bit more sugar water. But you're right. I do pick up on that, especially on the back end, more the alcohol comes through then. And speaking of which, alcohol.
I will kill it.
So we've got on today's episode of Whiskey Neat, we've got Greg Doxakis. Hi, Greg.
Is that how it's pronounced?
I have no idea. Give him a little more rum and cognac. He'll get it right. Doxakis. He's been talking to Doug Harris too long. He's giving me the Greek version of Doxakis.
Yeah. Doxakis.
Just pretend like you're reading the menu.
Right. Yeah.
Doxakis. And Greg Dox, he's the state manager for Maison Ferrand. They make the phenomenally fantastic plantation rum as well as Pierre Ferrand cognac. And then we also have Pasha Morchetti.
Good morning.
Pasha is our resident genius. He works at NASA. He's super fancy. And he also runs Rosewater, a very beloved, awesome bar that we will be talking quite a bit about. Not so much promoting, but just it really is a safe haven for branching out of your comfort zone.
I will promote you. Promote you all the way.
I will admit, I'm terrible. I hate self-promotion. It feels gross.
I could tell when you're the one posting on your Facebook. When your official Rosewater post, I could tell it's you because it's so you. I'm not comfortable doing this. But No. And it's not to promote Rosewater in the sense like, hey, no, but today's all going to be about branching outside. As you can see, it's Whiskey Neat, but this entire episode is going to be about branching outside your comfort zone, other barrel-aged spirits are out there, and they are worth your time and money. So, absolutely. And a lot of them way cheaper than whiskey. So,
thanks for having us, by the way.
Yeah, of course. Yeah, thank you. No, I'm super excited. So, we've got quite a bit lined up for today, including what I'm super excited about.
Yeah.
Pierre Ferrand's second Renegade barrel. This came out. The first one was a big hit, and I'll let you talk more about that in a second. I definitely want to come back to this rum, though. But we'll definitely get to the cognac aspect of it too. Rum barrels. Let's talk rum. So rum is going through the last few years. Whiskey's been through kind of a bit of a I don't want
to
say
boom. I hate to say bubble.
I really hate to say bubble because I don't see it dying down anytime soon. I think it may die down in certain regions, but Houston is on the upswing. I think we're doing phenomenally well whiskey wise.
I think it's expanded beyond its initial fairly niche club of people. I think just the awareness of it has just grown to maybe what we would consider appropriate.
Well, and rum's doing a little bit of that too overall in the Facebook world, and locally it does pretty well. But I see us moving as a group outside the whiskey and moving on to other stuff. I mean, the Renegade barrel alone was a great introduction. The first batch. We talked a lot about locally, and it's gone. I mean, it's all gone, and we loved
it's
it.
Almost gone. You might find a couple of.
If you know where it's at, please let me know. I was in Kentucky in January and passed it up because I didn't have room in my luggage. And when I got back, I just happened to find it, and of course, I bought half a case immediately. So
it's ludicrous to think that it's still on a shelf. It's been out for at least 6 months, right?
If you are not a cognac drinker, you're not really a rum drinker, if you're a whiskey drinker, I encourage you, if you can find it, and this is not just because Greg's a friend, but the Renegade Barrel Pierre Ferrand cognac is a whiskey, I hope this is not an insult, but I think it's a whiskey drinker's cognac. It's a nice introduction.
I call it the single malt drinker's cognac. And the reason why I say that, not that it's peaty or smoky, but I've always said that it's more at home in a rocks glass with an ice ball or in a Glencairn than it is in the snifter. When we started this whole thing with the Renegade Barrel Number One, we were excited about it, but we didn't know how it was going to play because it really wasn't quite the normal cognac drinkers' expectations, and we didn't know if it was going to bleed over to the other aficionados or the other drinkers. But and when it first landed, it was almost very quiet. It sneaked in. It didn't really blow up. There was a couple people that kind of appreciated it. I'd say some people who have always
That's
appreciated
Pierre Ferrand,
like Justin Burrow over at Bad News. You know, the guys over at Anvil. They, of course, immediately found appreciation for it. But it was just about December when not only some of the guys from the Houston Bourbon Society really caught on to it, thanks to you and some other guys, but the Republic reps. I did a meeting with them, with the reps that don't even carry the full-time work on these products, and I got texts from them saying they all went out and cleared the shelves.
Was it Nick Talamantes?
No.
Because he did the same thing.
And Nick, you know, and Nick does that a lot. These are reps that never do that. Let me put it this way. It's very rare that reps go and pay for booze. If you can get a rep to go out there and pay for booze, you got a winner.
Because
their houses are just full of it, you know?
Right.
I remember when that happened, too, because we had, when I picked it up, I remember actually tasting it. You had it in your bag. We were at a liquor store. We met by accident, I think, and you had a sample in your bag, and I tasted it, and I was blown away. We picked up bottles, and we were, in addition to giving people tastes of it to kind of dispel their preconceived notions of what cognac could be, we were making old-fashioned cocktails with it. And we had a few dedicated regulars that loved it, and suddenly I had a hard time finding it. It was probably about the time that the buzz kind of took off. So that was fun, but you know, a little frustrating when people find out the secret.
Well, absolutely. And so to back up a minute, so for those who don't know, I help run a group with a couple other guys called the Houston Bourbon Society. My colleagues Randy Svetlik and Matt Phillips. And I believe it was Wade, who a lot of people listening to this know who that is. Wade Woodard, I think back in early December or late November, had posted early on, like, just, hey, this is awesome. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that post got the love or focus it needed to.
Well, it did come from Wade, so.
Yeah. Automatically, a lot of doubt. Your sales dips is what happened.
So We love Wade.
And then I had posted about it once I circled around to it, and I think so did Alan Richards. And it immediately, I started seeing it in both local groups. And I know Nick had said that he had cleared the shelf at Rice locally. It just was a, it's just awesome. I mean, it's a gorgeous bottle. It's almost like its own little decanter. It's like got a really great look to it. And I'm sure this one has the same look. I'm going to take a look here.
Similar bottle, but we went kind of reverse color on the package and a little bit more, more going on the label.
You there's a zebra
it's,
there.
It's, yeah. There's a lot. Was zebra on the first one?
Was there? I drank it too fast.
I'll be happy to tell you about what the zebra means. But you know what's funny is that Renegade Barrel Number 1, we previewed it at last year's Whiskey Social.
Oh, really?
It was on the table.
That night was an absolute blur.
So, yeah, it's like it's
so. There's such a. One of these days, I'll get to the point where I can enjoy the festival a little bit. But that. So you were the. And for those who don't know, and this episode is actually sponsored by the Houston Whiskey Social. This episode will be. We'll be talking a little bit about that too. But I run a. There's a whiskey festival here locally that we had put together because. You know, we're the fourth largest city in the U.S., and they're really all the top three cities have like these incredible festivals that are just great. But Houston didn't really have a really mind blowing one, so at least in my opinion at the time. So, but it's we did 300 whiskeys, and this year it'll be in July. So I definitely visit HoustonWhiskeySocial.com. Pierre Ferrand was there. So we had you guys there. You guys were the only cognac that we let at the event. And it's not that we're prejudiced against cognac. I just really love your cognac. So, and then Plantation was the only rum there as well. So there's so many phenomenally fantastic barrel-aged spirits out there that I think a lot of people. So it's a give and take, like what you said, you hate it when the secret gets out, but at the same time, there's this, I want to spread the word because there's like almost a prejudice around certain spirits, rum, and I think a lot of that has to do with our history behind rum locally.
Yeah, I agree. But also, there's a lot of so branding has been almost too successful for certain spirits. So for a lot of times, rum was either a sort of fake coconut flavored rum or something that you just mix with Coke.
You can say Malibu. It's fine. It's a podcast. Yeah.
So people were drinking a lot of garbage. And almost the way cocktails were sort of ruined after Prohibition and up through the 80s and had to kind of be reclaimed, I think a lot of spirits suffered from that too. Rum developed an attitude that it was just this kind of silly, sweet pirate drink or something that you mix with Coke. Cognac, I think, developed unfairly a sort of staid reputation. This kind of just, old men, stuffy sort of old men in leather chairs.
Same sipping. Thing with scotch for a lot of people. There's a lot of guys locally who say that scotch is a rich man's drink, and it's not.
Yeah. Or in other cases, some cognacs became very closely associated with hip hop, and it kind of created this niche market for it. I think a lot of these spirits now are just kind of reclaiming their place on the stage, justifiably, and I joked about the secret getting out, but it's fun to share new things with people because it gets, quite frankly, it gets boring serving the same thing over every day.
You hit it on the head. It's trying new things.
Yeah.
You can have your favorites, but life is not life unless you get out of your comfort zone.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. As somebody who works behind a bar, the most fun that we have is, especially when it's quieter and we have the time to talk to people, is letting people try new things, for which a bar is a perfect setting because you don't have to commit to a whole bottle. And so we'll pull down bottles of Renegade. Oh, you think you don't like cognac? Well, here, try this.
Try this
is going to blow your mind. You think you don't like rum? Dude, check out this rum that's finished in Swedish peated malt barrels. It's incredible.
Well, there's historically everything goes through phases. And historically, like my grandfather was a this guy. My grandfather was a Beam guy. That's what he drank was Beam every day. And we are in such an opportunity for this hobby to try to branch outside your realm of comfort and really find a new hobby. Again, those who have been, like mezcals and rums and cognacs, those who are already in those hobbies don't want the extra competition in trying to gather stuff. But I think it can almost hurt a brand when you develop it around, like you said, hip hop. Because those who don't see themselves as that genre of music or that mentality, then they say, okay, well, that's not really my kind of drink.
Right, and that's unfortunate too. And there are layers to that. People who don't think that they want to drink what is popular in hip-hop culture might not want to drink cognac, however stupid that is. But it's a fact. Like, people have weird attitudes, and
it's all perception.
Yeah, it's all perception.
And getting outside your comfort zone is part of the reason why I wanted Pasha here today, because his bar, Rosewater, is a haven for experimentation, and it's something that I think is why it's been so successful. And
of booze. Let's just clarify that. Just of booze. We just
experiment. Wives, husbands. yes, there's a couple
hashtag
of
sanctuary.
This now all of a sudden makes me question some of the photos you've hung up in the hallway. But yeah, of booze. So, you know, there's branching out, and that's part of what the social did by having. I don't want to have a lot of filler at the event where it's, you know, we couldn't get enough whiskey brands, so we have six beers and three this and four that. I want to attract those who are cognac drinkers or rum drinkers and bring them to an event where they can find something interesting. We even had a wine last year, so that you know, wine is largely, in some ways, aimed at a lot of women, whereas whiskey's aimed a lot of times at men. And just even statistically speaking, these events see an overwhelming majority of men at them as opposed to women.
Yeah.
So I'd much rather, at least for me personally, my wife and I do a lot of this together. We got into it together.
Sure.
And we traveled to Scotland together. Mm. And my wife hated Islay whiskeys. She hated that peated smoke. But when you're stuck on Islay for 2 days or 3 days, and I wouldn't say stuck, but pleasantly abiding in or living in for a couple of days, all there is to drink is peated whiskey. So by the end of the 3 days, she was in love with Lagavulin. She was in love with Lafroig and Ardbeg.
We had a similar experience. My wife and I went to Italy. And, you know, she would never touch Campari. She used to make fun of me for shooting Campari. And now she is a full-blown she'll drink Americanos. That's one of her favorite drinks. And she also has learned to love the Aperol spritz there. So, yeah. Exactly.
And that's fair. And I think a lot of us, especially those of us who drink whiskeys, a lot of neat spirits, even some of the more aggressive Amari, I think some of us, especially those of us who have been drinking it for a while, have this idea that somehow we like it and therefore we sort of always liked it. But let's be honest, a lot of us started drinking shit. The first thing that I ever drank was this was Malibu rum. I remember I was in seventh grade and I had a shot of Malibu rum, and that was, from then on, that was my benchmark. And so when I first tried whiskey, which was, I think it was Johnny Walker Black, it, you know, it was kind of a shock. And so everybody has to grow into their tastes.
Yeah,
so,
and there's nothing wrong with Malibu rum. I mean, there's lots of.
You're sitting by a hotel pool somewhere in a resort somewhere. It's a Malibu rum, throwing a lot of orange juice or pina colada. Yeah. I mean, what are you gonna do?
I don't know, man. There's Clement makes a coconut rum that's pretty great. Awesome.
No, the Mahina coconut, yeah. And it's a delicious coconut, yeah. and it's not a coconut liqueur. It's truly, well, no, it is coconut liqueur, but made with their
based on the rum agricole.
But let's be honest, you're not gonna find a Clement Mahina coconut at all these bars. So, I mean,
yeah.
you wouldn't put it in a snifter and watch the legs on the latest, whatever flavor they got, the peaches and cream or not. But you're sitting by the pool of frozen drink.
Sour apple, this. Yeah. Right. Yeah. So, and that's my point about Rosewater is you guys carry such a vast selection, which is part of the reason why NASA Liquor has been so successful, is they have this massively wide selection for any of what your hobby entails. So whether it be those, liqueurs, or rums. I mean, the rum selection is just, every time I come there, it's more dope. Like, I love it. Their whiskey selection, they're one of the best mezcal selections in the city, if not the best, unless there's another place that has a great agave spirit selection. And I think NASA's it.
It helps me too, just to source product, because they're so close. And it's, you know, because I have a separate full-time job, I have to kind of balance that life with managing the bar. And so it helps to have a retailer that close that can find me unique, rare products that I can pick up on my way home from work and deliver to the bar. Their selection is awesome.
So you said the first thing you drank was Malibu, is that correct?
Yeah.
Can we go around the table on this? What was the first thing you snuck out of the liquor cabinet?
So my parents were not drinkers. I will have to say, one of the earliest spirits I can remember, and I'm almost embarrassed to even say it, it's the blue... hypnotic version, but it's the, what is the blue, Hypnotic's pink, right? Hypnotic's blue.
Yeah.
But there's a pink version of that the earliest, like,
the X-rated?
That's
it. Oh my God.
That's it, yeah. Yeah, one of the earliest drinks that someone gave me.
How young are you?
Man, the beard hides it.
So I'm 30.
Like 16 years old.
Okay. Oh, wow, okay.
Yeah.
So,
yeah.
Okay, so
God, you're only 30. Yeah.
So no, I was like, actually, that's not that old. But my father wasn't a drinker, neither. Not a drinker as well, as I should say, but he had an excellent liquor cabinet, and because he just liked to entertain, we had big family gatherings, and he liked to have the good stuff to share. But having said that, the first sneak out of the liquor cabinet for me was Midori.
And I'm glad that we shared like a shitty, but I was, fruity liqueur.
But I was not in seventh grade. I think it was more maybe fifth.
Nice. So,
but yeah, it was candy, and I found out the hard way it was not.
Yeah, it's not my. But everyone progresses. You start off with what's readily available. I remember my first high school, college, legal age party that I went to where I was 21 for sure, and not really, but I tried beer for the first time from a keg, and I was like, beer's not for me. But by the end of the night, and you're upside down somewhere, you drink enough of it, you learn to enjoy something, some part of it, until you move on to some other stuff. And then you go from your Bud Lights and your light beers. You remember your first Shiner Bock, thinking that was craft beer? And, I mean, I think it still is craft beer legally, but it was my first like Shiner Bock. And then you move on to St. Arnold.
I think I remember my first Dogfish Head IPA. That was probably one of the
Dogfish Head was the first craft beer that I fell in love with.
For a lot of us. It was also readily available. They had good distribution.
Raison d'Etre was like my number one favorite craft beer for a long time. And then you move on to, I mean, we've exploded in that
market. Black out a few times and you're like, well, I need to slow it down a little bit.
Yeah, well, I don't know about that.
What did y'all think of that?
I thought it was delicious.
This is the Panama 12-year. It has the double maturation with the Pierre Ferrand cognac, but also the triple maturation with the whiskey barrels. I always get this word right. Arran, A-R-R-A-N.
Isle of Arran,
Arran. This is a private selection for the Austin Shaker in Austin. It's we were talking about, you know, the liquor stores that
do private barrels.
They do, well, not only do the private barrels, but also dare to have that selection of things that the connoisseur is looking for and those who dare to try new things are looking for. And it's an excellent store out there in Austin. It's on...
You actually bring up
North Airline.
You actually bring up a point I wanted to mention. So a lot of spirits will borrow from other fads. You know, you'll see a scotch that says bourbon
on
it.
Yeah. Crown, the bourbon
crown
mash.
Crown Royal bourbon mash.
If we put the word bourbon on the label, people will buy it.
So the a lot of people borrow, but what I love about real spirits is just borrowing from those things subtly, you know, like... A perfect example is you guys do some aging in cognac barrels or whiskey barrels just to influence the spirit so that when people try it, they taste it on its own without the preconceived gimmick or the – you get what I'm saying? Crown Royal Bourbon Mash is clearly a gimmick, but when you taste plantation rum in a Isle of Arran scotch cask, it doesn't – come across like you're trying to borrow from that popularity of that hobby. Does that make sense?
No, yeah. I think they're just trying to give complexity to a spirit.
Correct. Which is the whole point is you're trying to offer something unique on its own as opposed to on the surface presenting a difference.
Yeah, and I think the great part about some of these finished plantation rums is that they serve two purposes, at least from my perspective if I'm talking to a guest. So if you're someone who just likes a delicious rum and you don't want to think about it too much, you just want to taste something, especially if you're drinking it neat, then it satisfies you. This is just a 12-year-old Panamanian rum.
Yeah. Agreed.
So this one, it's 12-year-old Panamanian rum. It's delicious. That's it. Simple. I like it. It tastes good. But if you're someone who really appreciates the nuances of malt whiskey, and I tell you that it's finished in an Arran barrel or that Swedish malt that I was talking about earlier, you can find it in there. If you want to dig around and spend some time, you can do that too. And even if it's the same person on a different day, maybe you're not in the mood to think about it too much. So just drink some delicious rum. Maybe I want to explore a little bit, so I'll dig my nose in there and I'll find some of that barrel characteristic. It's really fun in that respect.
Find the connection to your own hobby through the spirit without the label.
Yeah.
Right? So the great thing about plantation, in my opinion, is being able to, like this one's done in a Willet Rye cask, is to taste it. And they're really anything barrel aged. They're cousins. They're all related. There's going to be some genetic qualities that are similar in terms of, I say genetic, but as a whiskey drinker, heavily, I love plantations, higher proof products. I think they're just phenomenally complex.
See, that you touched an interesting point too, because I think that for a lot of bourbon drinkers, particularly, or you know, and maybe some malt drinkers too, there is when you drink that whiskey, when you taste it, there is a sort of, this is going to sound bad, but like an aggressiveness to it. There's a character to, especially American whiskey, that is different than a lot of rums. And as rums and brandies as well, as they get higher in proof, at least I've found it's easier to get whiskey drinkers to relate to them because they're used to slightly more aggressive flavors.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So like, for example, a lot of very traditional cognacs at 80 proof, they're very easygoing. They're, as some people would describe, which is something that kind of makes me wince, they're smooth. And while some people are looking for that,
which I hate that word, I hate it. Smooth denotes boring. You know,
well, it also denotes nothing. Yeah. You know, let's touch on that. But go ahead.
Here's the thing, and so this is like, I think we're just like building tangents upon tangents, but that's cool, man.
That's what happens in a podcast.
Yeah. So so the smooth thing, yeah, I hate it. It sucks. Like when somebody describes something to me as tasting smooth, I don't know how to respond because all that means is that for me, at least, as someone who drinks a lot, that means that it's kind of insipid, but. Man, there's a ton of people that want something that is quote unquote smooth. I think what they're afraid of is an alcoholic burn, maybe.
Correct.
So that's not.
They're coming from shooting.
Agreed. Yeah.
That's the feel, and so I think what I usually tell them when they're being smooth, I go, I think what you mean is soft. It's soft on the palate. It's got a soft mouth feel. It's not aggressive. So I think back to your point, why so many whiskey drinkers love the higher proof one. It's not always the taste. It's just how it feels.
Exactly. Yeah. Which is a huge part of it too. And quite frankly, sorry, Chris.
No, you're fine.
But there are a lot of people that don't care about how something tastes. Now, these are not the sophisticated whiskey drinkers that we're probably talking about listening to this program on a Saturday or whenever they're listening to it, but there's some people that just want something that gets them drunk.
Yeah.
And doesn't
with a purpose.
Hurt them.
Yeah.
It'll get you there.
Which is where that X-rated and hypnotic conversation comes from. But no, you reach a point, even coming from a background of non-drinkers, I was always raised to I remember sitting in my pastor's office as a young buck, being told that, you know, why would you drink? Drinking is to get drunk. It doesn't taste good.
That's so sad.
And it's stuck with me because as I've gotten older, I could not disagree more. Some of these things are incredibly complex. And I tell people all the time, like, you pick up notes of Wade likes to say the word spearmint, right? Or notes that you know were not added to the product. They're not in the barrel. But somehow you're tying in notes of caramelized sugars and all these things that were not added. They come from the spirit, and you're tasting notes on things that weren't added. They're just natural.
Yeah,
it's an adventure.
And let's be honest, I understand that obviously there's some people that can't drink anymore, and that's or don't drink at all, and that's sad.
And that's fair enough.
But there are flavors that you get in spirits, in barrel aged spirits, that you simply cannot get anywhere else, and they are delicious flavors. And so for that reason alone is enough to drink. You know, I mean, the effects of the alcohol are sort of, I don't want to say secondary, but
yeah.
You know, they're fun in moderation. I agree with your pastor. I hate being drunk. I hate it.
Mm-hmm.
And part of it is because I start to lose the ability to appreciate the spirit that I'm drinking.
Of course. And it blows your palate. No, that's why a lot of master distillers will taste and blend it at 60 proof because they don't want to blow out their palates.
True. Yeah.
And then of course, you know, by tasting through 50 things in one day, you're going to become inebriated. So, sure. So breaking that down a little bit focuses on the spirit itself.
And not all of us are 30-year-old young men, Chris. Some of us have 2-day hangovers that we get now.
Exactly. 2 days. I wish.
I may be 30, but I look 40. So God, I have four kids and no sleep. So I'm like that spirit producer in California that's using a reactor to speed up the process.
Yeah.
I'm a 5-gallon barrel is what I am. I age a lot faster than you typical 53-gallon guys.
Did you taste your own stuff?
So you brought this today, but when I told you I ordered this overseas, I also ordered a couple of those bottles because I saw that they had them, and I really, have you tried them yet, the Lost Spirits?
No, I've actually never tried them.
But you've heard of them, right?
Yeah,
he uses some sort of reactor to break down some scientific
this. It reminds me of that guy that in the early 2000s said he was a time traveler, and he took a picture of some ridiculous contraption that was supposed to be his time machine, and that's what I think of when I think of the Lost Prairie. I've never tried it. It could be legit. I have no idea.
Have you tried it?
I think there's something to be said.
I was polite.
I think there's some things that only time and climate can do.
Here's the thing. I actually had a friend that I used to work with years ago, Downing Street, you know, the cigar bar.
Heartbroken.
He was a smart guy, smart guy, and he kind of had this idea himself. He's like, well, what if we did this? And he was a whiskey purist. You know, his idea of a light whiskey was a Lafroig. But he kind of came to his own conclusion. You know what? That's probably not a good idea. I don't think that would go right. It could work, but it's probably not going to go right.
I think it's good that people try it. I think it's always good to try and innovate, even if it's – and this is from my other background. As
progression.
You know, the purpose of experimentation is not necessarily to get the answer that you expect every single time. Finding out what doesn't work is just as important as finding out what does work. And so from that perspective, I think it's great.
Being progressive is why culinary – innovations happen, and I'm super happy with that. But it's like you said, some things, when they don't work, they don't work. And I'm all for you trying to find shortcuts or find new ways to innovate. But if it doesn't work, it doesn't work.
Now, the other side of that is this huge boom that we're seeing in like fruit flavored so-called whiskeys.
Are we seeing a boom in that?
Dude, it's caramel. There's like 15 different types of Crown Royal now.
There's a bacon one out too.
It's like Pop-Tarts.
Bacon bourbon.
Yeah. So you can do a bacon fat infused bourbon.
Which is, you know.
Why?
Yeah.
Fat infused vodka and save yourself the trouble.
Yeah. I'm more worried about the health effect. I mean, I'm closing in on 50, so, you know.
When you pour it out of the bottle, it comes out in clumps.
Yeah. And you have to filter it out, and it's fun. Like, we've done it before, and it gives you a I think the guys at PDT up in New York did it first, at least that I'm aware of, in like the mid 2000s or whatever. But it's a fun little way to add some smoky, meaty flavor to your bourbon. You make an old fashioned with it, but it's. That's different than adding, again, like maple biscotti, whatever, birthday cake, cinnamon abomination whiskey.
I had one not so long ago. It was a sprinkled donut vodka.
Sprinkled donut?
Yeah, so the cover looked like the
Homer
Simpson
donut.
What's
crazy to me is that there are people, because we get this a lot, people who, if they're looking for cocktails, they want something. Everybody, the phrase, like, not too sweet is what you hear a lot.
Yeah, my wife hates sweet cocktails.
Sure, yeah.
She likes a lot of fun, interesting, take me on a roller coaster, but don't cover me in sugar.
And a lot of people say that, but then some of the number one selling products are heavily dosed with artificial flavor and sugar and, you know, sprinkles.
Yeah, I always get pings of guilt on this because I was at a liquor store the other day that was closing out Dude. Remember Dude? It was the Three Olives Mountain Dew flavored vodka.
No, I don't remember that.
And I used to work for a pub back then. I had a hand in this. I was like, sorry, my bad. And this is the thing, though. But, you know, it'd be nice if we could get if everyone could appreciate their spirits and the class and quality. But it's kind of hard to tell someone you shouldn't do that. We can't. You know, it's hard to tell them how not to have a good time.
Absolutely.
Right.
If that's your thing, if that's your idea.
There's an audience for everything.
Exactly.
Right, there's a reason why a lot of Texas whiskeys, there's a lot of guys locally I know of that are real roughneck plant workers who love Garrison Brothers. They enjoy that. Aggressive oil, you know, corn. I always liken it to like a benzene, like a not gasoline.
It's almost unctuous. Like, it has this like lanolin like sort of character to it.
It's got its audience.
Yeah,
and like most things do. So, but yeah. Anyway, so this is great. I like it. It's less sweet than the first one, which the Trinidad. Are we allowed to taste these two?
You can, yeah, absolutely.
Please.
I wouldn't toy with you like that.
If we're going to drink, let's drink.
So, but this one, went back on this Panama one, you know, Panama rums, especially the older age ones, are very rich. You know, they usually get that that super dessertish thing going
especially
on.
Especially for a Spanish style of
right.
rum.
But the whiskey cask really just kind of puts a little extra something on top of it that steers it in a different direction.
Especially in the finish. You know? I didn't notice it on the first sip, but on the second sip, I really kind of noticed that whiskey.
The nose on this is really great. Oh, wow.
Yeah, this is the Peru, and this was selected by...
Yeah. Oh, yeah, sweet.
Speaking of which, for those Houston fans who don't already know, I'm sure everyone does, but the first Willet barrel to hit Texas in quite some time will be here at 8 Row Flint.
Sweet.
Speaking of 8 Row Flint, this was selected by Morgan Weber. And will be available only at 8 Row Flint. Awesome. And
so would it be fair to assume he picked that barrel, and because he loved it so much, he went and got the Willet from Kentucky?
I would not assume it, but I'm going to declare it.
You're going to take that, credit for it?
Yes, I'm taking credit for it, that Willett owes me 10% of whatever he's getting for that.
I wish I lived closer to that bar, man.
So I always tell people, it's intense.
Mm-hmm. This is awesome.
I'm a recent, I won't say convert to Aeroflint. I didn't realize how phenomenal it was.
I mean, the place is incredible.
And when I went there, mm-hmm. their back bar immediately reminded me of your back bar.
There's this big. This
he's got a great mezcal selection.
Yeah, it's
and,
awesome.
And speaking of branching out, look, it's great to have a whiskey bar that has 4,000 whiskeys, but I think you're doing yourself a disservice if you don't branch out outside of your comfort zone at a place like Aeroflint or Rosewater.
No question about it. Okay. It frustrates me when we're presenting spirits to, like, let's say, one that specializes in this place. A lot of whiskey bars these days, and they say, "Yeah, well, we sell just mostly whiskey," and it's just frustrating. I mean, you're so short-sighted. Don't be so short-sighted. Okay. I mean, keep your mind open and see, as you said earlier, how these things are not necessarily genetically, but there's relation to them. You know, you can find correlation in the flavors and things that they're going to enjoy in whiskey. They can find in other spirits.
Three of these could not be more different.
No, completely. Yeah,
they're completely different.
And that's exactly the thing. So, speaking of, sorry, Greg, I want to hijack you a second.
Posh's all riled up today.
Yeah, so we have, I mean, I don't know, of bourbon in particular, we have, I don't know, more than 50 bottles. Quite frankly, at some point, they all start to taste the same. Obviously, there are differences, but you can only have so much. The beautiful thing, though, I'm going to jump ahead now to these rums, is that rum, just like any spirit, there's a huge amount of diversity. So these are all three different barrels of three rums from the same producer. And even within these three, you have ridiculous amounts of diversity.
So, but let's clarify that, though. When we say producer.
Well, that's, yeah.
Right.
Same bottle, I should say.
We want to be very transparent about, to be very clear about that, is that there is no plantation distillery.
Notice I didn't say distillery.
But you guys own several.
We own the West Indies Rum Distillery in Barbados, which is the largest one in Barbados. And we own a piece of Long Pond and Money Musk in
Money
Jamaica.
Musk,
and there's one more, which
I
name
escapes
me
right now.
But the point is that plantation, the whole idea behind the brand is that there is a difference. And now we just said there's a difference in these three, but the main reason is not because of the finishing that we did, though very much so does have an influence, but the countries, Panama rum is different from Peru rum, which is different from Trinidad. It comes down to not only distillation methods and fermentation methods, but terroir.
Yeah.
Absolutely. The climate, what the geographical.
The soil, all of it.
Absolutely. And we're proud of that. We're proud of the fact that plantation is going to be a celebration of the grand terroir of rum. There are so many great brands out there, too many to name. But the thing is, though, is that their different expressions are going to be different expressions of the same rum from the same country, which is fine. There's nothing wrong with that whatsoever. But what's neat about plantation is from bottle to bottle to label and expression, it's going to be such a different taste experience because of that.
Yeah, and it even says even on some of the like the sort of the well products like the plantation dark, even on that label it tells you exactly what countries it's from.
Sure.
Yeah.
You know, it's interesting you mentioned that one, because that one, you know, it all comes back to Pierre Fron, it all comes back to cognac and the practices that we do in cognac that we started influencing on plantation, is that we do this thing called the bonificature, we call it the bonifier, and that is in all of our cognacs. There's going to, no matter what age they are, no matter how young, there's going to be some super old cognac that's going to be added to that barrel to kind of kickstart it and kind of give it a foundation. And that's what we did with the original dark. It is, for the most part, young Trinidad with a little bit of super old Jamaican in there to give it a foundation.
And there's a little bit of that Jamaican funk that I love about it.
I love Jamaican funk.
I'm sorry, dude, Morgan Weber, this is amazing. I cannot... I never get the chance to get up to Aeroflint. It's just so far for me, but this is awesome.
So on a side note, that is his Peru, but we will be releasing later this year a single vintage Peru plantation rum that will not be aged in a triple aged in the Willett. But we're also coming out, this one's going to be fun, a Fiji.
Really?
Fiji rum.
Sweet. I saw that.
Yeah. We get vintages every now and then. I bring in 2 a year to Texas. Last year we did the Jamaican 2002, which is still by far my favorite Jamaican rum we've done so far. And also we did that little freak show, the St. Lucia 2005. Have you had it?
No.
I have it.
Do you have it?
I have it.
Yeah, you should.
You have it with you right now? Yeah. Let's do that.
So, it is right here. It's... It's nine years in the St. Lucia barrels, bourbon barrels in St. Lucia, 18 months in the Pierre Ferrand barrels back in France. Yeah. Help yourselves there, gentlemen. It's going to be, it's such a neat little product, and unfortunately we're never going to see it again because the producer that is making this is no longer outsourcing rum, which is fine. You know, they want to do their own thing. You know, there's no ill will, no hard feelings. Just it's nice to get it while we had it. So it's going to have a pour and a taste. So the it's going to be funky. Yeah, I was going to say, man, put it's day off. You're making them work. You know, it's going to have a funk to it. Not duplicate of a Jamaican funk, but definitely funky all the same. But man, it's got some stewed fruit and baking spices, and it has almost this quality of a think of a fortified wine. That may have been turned a little bit, just sat out one day too long. Not in a bad way, but the rancio on it is just so deep in that regard.
It's the great thing about Plantation in general is, you know, single barrel products of the same exact spirit, same exact mash bill, same exact, you know, like with bourbon, are great, but there's not really an urge or real reason to collect every single one that you come across. But with Plantation, it's such a vast spectrum, literally covering thousands of miles of the Caribbean, right? Square miles. I don't know how many square miles the Caribbean exists of, but it's you've got rum coming from 20 different countries. I don't know how many you guys have done, but
and then some,
and of course they all make their trip up to France to age a little bit longer, and it's just a fun reason to go out and of course, what's the price point? So a lot of bourbons for your private barrel picks can be $60-$70. A lot of these rums are $30-$40.
They're super
reasonably priced, and you're talking about this is a nine year this one.
9 years in St. Lucia, 18 months in Ferrand in cognac barrels.
Yeah, there's a reason to try them because they're so vastly different.
This has that really intense like phenolic St. Lucian quality. It's like, so it's there's some Hamilton rums, some St. Lucian,
sure,
that are super intense. And you've for a lot of people hate it, honestly, but this is toned down. This is much more approachable, I think.
Yeah, I've had this in this rum, and I know what you mean about some people hate it. I think it's just it's a delicious rum. It's so complex and deep, and it's just not for the novice.
Yeah,
no,
I guess what I mean is that even so, the Hamilton St. Lucian is super intense, and I've had if for us it's very polarizing. People mostly hate it because they're not used to it. This is much more toned down. So even if you've had a St. Lucian, I would recommend trying this one.
And this is the thing. I think that actually your average rum drinker might not enjoy this one, but I think your single malt and those who like an explosion of flavors in the whiskey world, they would adore this one.
Go ahead. You're fine.
I was going to say, this is one of the things that it's fun to do at a bar, just working behind a bar, is to give people a chance to try things that they might not otherwise. So let's say you come in, because I think we have, dude, I don't know, like 10, 12, 13 of some of these rums here. And we'll do flights so that people can try. They don't want to commit to a whole bottle, so they can come in and try a half.
That's why you go to a bar to begin with. Solution.
Exactly.
Just branch out.
And in some cases, people will they'll taste the Barbados or they'll taste the Jamaican and or maybe the St. Lucian. They're like, oh my God, this is not for me at all. But at least they've figured out what they like. They've helped develop their taste.
And honestly, I think that's just a matter of time. If you approach a spirit with a preconceived notion and it throws you off, you may not like it at first, but come back to it, revisit a new one with an open mind. This actually reminds me, do you remember a couple years ago Ardbeg did Ardbeg Perpetuum, which was largely not liked by the typical Ardbeg fans?
Yeah.
But Ardbeg Perpetuum and Isle of Malt had a very malted barley. I enjoyed it, and I kind of pick up on this. On the finish, reminds me of a little bit of a malted barley. It reminded me of Ardbeg Perpetuum, an Isle of Smoke, but not quite smoky, just a little bit malted barley on the back end. It was a very interesting
that slight iodine-ish on the tongue, that sort of thing.
It's really interesting from start to finish. The nose is completely different. It's weird in a good way.
I get it. It's a weird rum, but it's a weird rum in a good way. It's almost like a Fellini movie. You guys gotta keep watching, you know.
It's a fun rum.
It's a little too cerebral for us right now, man.
We're getting too deep.
A few more.
The funny thing, so Chris, you just mentioned something that I think is interesting that we kind of deal with a lot. The what people think of as smoke,
It's way off.
So yeah. We'll serve people sometimes unpeated scotch.
And they say it's too smoky.
Know for a fact that there's no peat, and they're like, oh no, this is too smoky. And a part of the challenge is, I think, especially for people tasting and
is correcting them without coming off as a
well, I mean, it's a challenge. Like, and you don't, because you're like,
you want to teach them, like, but you don't want to be condescending.
Yeah, 2 + 2 = 4. Yeah, exactly. But the other thing is, I think a lot of people are intimidated by trying new things because they also don't know that they have the language for it. So my girlfriend Selena, she drinks a lot of whiskey with me. She's someone who used to hate peated scotch. She used to hate mezcal. And now she loves it. Mm-hmm. She always gives me a hard time when I introduce her to some new spirit that she discovers she loves because she has a new vice, she says. But she doesn't nerd out on this stuff like we do. She just likes things or she doesn't.
Yeah.
And so if I give her something to try, a lot of times she'll be at a loss for words other than to say, yeah, it's good, I like it. And the trick is allowing people to do that. I think making them feel comfortable.
To let them enjoy it without being a prude about it.
Exactly. Just to say,
not a prude, but a snob.
Right. They don't. You don't have to describe to me that you find toasted coconut or almonds and figs. And
you don't have to use the word treacle as opposed to.
If you do, you can leave. No, just like, it's okay to just like something and not be able to describe why you like it.
Right.
Because for God's sake, this is just booze, right? Like, it's supposed to be tasty and make you feel good. That's it.
Yeah.
So that's cool. Try new stuff and just tell me if you like it or don't.
My wife has never been a rum person, and I recently introduced her to – I say recently. I want to say 6 months ago, I introduced her to an old 17-year-old Caroni, and she hated it. Dude, she hated it.
Those are intense, man.
She hated it.
Good Lord.
It was funky. She really hated it. And then since then, though, we've done a lot of plantation experiments, and she's changed her mind. And it's just a matter of once you – when you approach a spirit, when you, like, for instance, the reason why some people have a hard time with some whiskeys, like Texas whiskeys, perfect example, because in their mind, they're expecting to taste a Kentucky profile. And then you taste a Texas whiskey, and you're like, it's not anything like what you expected from bourbon, so you're weirded out by it. It takes a minute for you to kind of clean the slate of preconceived notions and just approach it open-minded as opposed to expecting something from it.
Yeah. And it's okay. I mean, you know, so that 17-year-old Caroni stuff is super intense. And it's okay, especially if you don't know, if you're not familiar with it, it's pretty polarizing. It's okay if you taste it several times and you never end up liking it. I think the idea is just that you have to be open-minded. That's it. You know what I mean? Like, you can, if you don't want to like Texas whiskey, cool, don't drink it. There's lots of other stuff to drink. If you don't like a St. Lucian rum, whatever, man, that's cool.
But doesn't that bother you? And we obviously agree, like, that sort of thing is not for the novice, but doesn't it bother you when there's something that you want to like?
Oh,
you try it again and again and again. It's like, damn it, I want to like it, but I just don't. Yeah. You know, but that's okay. Not everything's for everyone. You know?
Yeah.
So we're definitely going to run over our hour here, and I'm okay with that completely. Is that okay with you, Red Band? All right. So just to kind of move forward a little bit, I had a couple questions I wanted to approach. Please, for those wondering, explain what élevage and dosage, if I'm butchering those words.
Oh, I do it all the time. I got to practice my French, and every now and then I do it too French. So French, I can mingle with you.
Mr. Doxagaxix is going to talk about élevage.
Élevage
and dosage. So, one is part of another. Élevage is actually going to be, in its origin, a wine term, and the literal meaning is to nurture. And it's just basically your process of from production till it gets into the bottle. What steps are you taking to make that spirit the best that you can make? And it's really just the simple answer on that one. But dosage is part of that, and dosage is going to be the practice of adding some sweeteners to the spirits to round it out. Or sometimes there's some producers that want to make it a huge piece of it to where it's the flavor profile. Our approach at Pierre Ferrand, and this goes for our cognacs and for our rums, is that we do not practice dosage to make it a different product. We use the dosage to make it a complete product. And for the record, we don't use it for all of our rums or all of our cognacs. It's going to depend on what expression it is. And it is sugar. But let's be clear about this. It's not like we have big, you know, bags of imperial sugar sitting around, you know, the distillery. It's
I can,
the case.
I can feel people listening to this and getting their posture tightened right now.
and let me interject there. So for those who don't know, there is a certain section of the population who are purists when it comes to spirits. They're not fans. They feel like you are bastardizing a product when you add additives to the product. Now, and for a large part of that, that may be the case, that they're really trying to cover up a spirit. Mm-hmm. And I've actually been guilty of making that claim with some whiskeys where in the process of creating a product, if it's not quite worthy of that brand's if it doesn't meet their minimum standards to be released, it doesn't taste like their typical product. And it's very important to brands to have a consistency with the quality, right? So they don't want to release a bourbon that doesn't taste like what their bourbon typically tastes like, because then you alienate your guy who's a Jack Daniels guy, so to speak. So a lot of your choice then is to either throw that product away or to change it and rebrand it. And so there is some people who are against that idea.
And it's tricky, man. I mean, we don't live in a black and white world, period. It's an entirely gray area. So, like, for example, for bourbon and rye whiskey, American and Canadian, we don't carry anything that's not straight. Wade Woodard, God love him, is the evangelist of straight spirits, mm-hmm. because he doesn't like adulterated whiskeys, and I love him for it. And I agree, it's great. There are a lot of blended whiskey-like products out there that are adulterated with artificial flavors to go back to that smooth term, because people want to taste something smooth and easy. And we don't carry stuff like that. But that is not the same, quite frankly, as what some cognac producers do or some rum producers.
Well, and there may be a specific spirit.
Sorry.
No, you're fine. There may be a specific spirit in which historically every time someone added something, it was because it was a bad product.
Sure.
So, or not at, well, let me rephrase the wording here. There may be certain hobbies in which the tendency there was to.
I think you're dead on.
Okay.
And history has shown us that yes, and that there has been times that spirits, they put in sugar to mask a bad product. There's no question about it. It's a big part of a spirit's
history. But
that's not, history.
They're not mutually exclusive.
Exactly. So it's okay to say that. And I just want to be very clear about something. And there is, it's great to be a purist. But a purist tells you how they feel. A fascist tells you how you should feel about it. And then there's and sometimes there's a fine line. I mean, it's okay to be a purist in the sense that this is what you appreciate. But when you tell others that if you don't appreciate it the way which you appreciate it, then you are the person that's in the wrong.
Yeah, and that's a pretty good analogy. I also think though that even I used to think of myself in a lot of ways as a purist, and that at some point though, if you're truly honest with yourself, you have to realize that. You cannot have a purity test for everything, that there are always exceptions. And so as long as you, I think, have a general set of guidelines that allow you to choose what you drink and what you sell, that you're, as long as you try to find honest people, I think that's the biggest thing, is that, you know, Plantation is open. Pure Fran is open about what they do. And so that's cool.
And that's and Wade, speaking of Wade being a purist, he's a big fan of the products. He's a huge fan. And you guys have always been transparent, almost to a very minute detail, transparent.
Wade and I missed each other by a matter of 12 hours at Chateau Bonbonnet in France. You know, my crew was leaving as he and his wife, Katrina, thank you, sorry. Oops, sorry, Wade. so it was, we're rolling in. Yeah,
I saw the egg thing.
The egg
barrel.
The egg is awesome.
Yeah, so
honestly, guys,
I also saw what someone did to that photo. I'll show you off air.
I don't want to. But I do want to back up a little bit about the whole thing, because I want to be clear about this, and that is that the sugar, the dosage, are a process. In the French, it's a sucre toast, it's toasted sugar. It's a very Demerara-esque rich syrup that we produce at the distillery. Made with cognac,
and it's not a quick process, right?
No, not at all. It's literally aged in barrels, and the amounts that we're putting inside each batch are just minute. I forgot how you put it.
In a recent interview with Alexander Gabriel, his exact wordage was very, very specific, and I absolutely loved it. I actually flagged it for this conversation. His exact words was, the maximum allowed is 16 grams per liter. Just to explain what that means, next time you drink your coffee, you would have to split a number 4 sugar cube into 12 pieces and use just one of those 12 pieces in your coffee. It is such a minute additive that it's really not, you know, gallons of flavoring. You know, it's not what some purists might immediately assume and write off.
Again, I can feel people tighten it up. I love it.
And I respect that opinion. If your opinion is that you prefer your spirit with nothing added to it whatsoever other than what was fermented, distilled, and whatever elements it gets imparts from the wood, I'm not going to tell you that you're wrong.
Aging spirits in barrels is itself a way to modify the flavor of the spirit, even if it was not.
It's 100% what they're doing. Especially
if you're using a barrel that one time held any sort of wine.
Sherry finished scotch and bourbon, even, because they do those.
I've had some sherry finished malt whiskeys that tasted more like sherry than
malt.
And
no one writes those off. No one ever thinks it's a you're covering an inferior product. It's a more.
Sure, someone in the world does.
Well, I just meant in general the zeitgeist of snobbery is not that barrel finished single malt. Macallan 12 is one of, I think, the most consistent 12-year-old full sherry maturation single malts out there, and I think it's great for $50.
Yeah, and quite frankly, who cares if a couple people don't like a very specific product? Cool, that's their opinion. They don't have to drink it, but who cares? Everybody has different tastes. They have different perspectives. They have different ideas, and they're allowed to have that. In the meantime, we'll drink some rum.
Do y'all want to taste something that is not going to be available any place in North America except for the great state of Texas?
So tell the story here.
Barbados 2007. This one is going to be aged in a bourbon cask in its native country of Barbados.
The empty glass.
Of course, it's going to have the double maturation of Pierre Ferrand. Mm-hmm. But we're going one more step, and we are using cognac barrels, Baudry cognac barrels, barrels that at one time held Baudry cognac. And the unique thing about this one is, and to my knowledge, other than our OFTD, especially with the single vintage, is going to be the highest proof. This one's coming in 117 proof.
I just rinsed the St. Lucian out of the glass with the Panamanian.
This kind of smells like...
It's weird because it's less intense. It's weird to rinse your glass with another rum.
This kind of smells almost like bourbon. It's got kind of a...
Yeah, the heat on this one is going to be unprecedented.
Maybe that's what it is.
With one of our
single casks, what it is.
For sure.
So this is coming to Texas, and this is the single cask Barbados 2007.
Yeah. What it actually is, it's along the same line of the ones that we personalize, but this one was just so there was no way I could personalize this for one entity. It would have been a riot. You know, would have been fights in the streets. So I'm keeping this one open to the general public.
So the barrel is let me just make sure I understand. The sample's here, no one else has had it. But this barrel is set for Texas? Like anyone can buy it?
Correct.
Right. So you're sampling it around to see who wants to bring it in?
No. I'm bringing it in, and it's going to be distributed by RNDC
to
any bar or retail store that wants to carry it.
And you're talking, 150 bottles, 180 bottles?
Let's see, 23 times 6.
23 times 6.
I think I'm getting 23 six-packs on this, I think. So
like 130 bottles?
Yeah.
This is intense, son.
Yes. It's in
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
I just got a flavor that I cannot describe, and it reminds me of my childhood. And it's freaking me out. So this is another example.
There's a joke there. I almost made.
he had 117 proof job.
This is another good example. So right now, I can't think about what that flavor is, but I love it, and that's okay. It's okay.
It's okay to love it.
It's okay It's okay not to be able to describe what you're tasting.
To describe it. This is
a
punch in the face. It is. Wow.
There's tropical fruit notes to it, but there's something else, man.
I wonder what a dash of water would do to this.
We're all just in here smacking into the mic.
Yeah.
This is good, man.
So,
this
is good radio. Real quick. 23 times 6. I'm trying to figure out
this is not a math podcast.
138 bottles coming to Texas or Houston?
To Texas.
or Houston.
Houston will get a pretty good
Houston
share.
Houston will.
don't get me in trouble with my North Texas people, okay?
Wow,
no, it's gonna be great. You know, look, it's I don't think it's gonna sell out overnight. I think it's going to be for very particular consumers. You know,
that's the beautiful part about rum. For the most part, is that it's still not. There's not as much of a frenzy around releases, so you can still find it kind of casually.
I would encourage those listening that if you're not quite there in your rum world, find a rum that is well recommended and well liked, like maybe some Plantation products. Buy it, and then when you get there, you'll have it. You'll have some of these stuff that's not going to be available when this barrel gets here. It'll be gone, and then it's gone forever.
Yeah.
Buying some products to come back to again. I've been buying. I'm a huge Laphroaig supporter. I've been buying Laphroaig for years, and now my wife is finally to the point where it's been a couple of years now, but she's to the point where she can really enjoy it. And now she has these old bottles from, you know, several years ago that aren't no longer made. Like we've got one of those, the 1992 vintages and the black tube is just phenomenal.
Yeah. Mm.
And you can't find it anymore. So now she gets to come back to it now that she's caught up to where... what's that?
Belize?
No. It's a Scotch.
Oh, I'm sorry.
The Laphroaig.
But at the same time, so that is true, and it's nice. And I've got some old bottles of whiskey that some malt that I haven't really ever gotten around to drinking. And I'm glad I still have them. Some like old Ardbeg, like the some Oogies. They're pretty good. But at the same time, because I always worry that when people hear a story about some product that's going to be relatively limited, that they're going to hoard it. I wouldn't recommend doing that because you're always going to find good product. Right, like there's quite frankly, like yeah. So, a lot of the old Weller stuff isn't the Stetzel Weller stuff doesn't exist anymore, and it's but there's a lot of good bourbon out there. There's a lot of good rum out there right now. There's a lot of good spirits out there right now. This Renegade Barrel, for example, the second one.
Oh yeah,
there's more and more stuff that's coming out. It's really delicious every day. So even if you don't get a bottle of this new Plantation coming out, dude, there's still tons of good stuff out there.
Oh, of course. I just mean that there are things that coming from me that. 7 years ago, you know, people like you've been doing this a long time. 7 years ago, if I had known, if someone had just said something, there would be bottles in my collection that I am kicking myself for passing over and not even knowing it's there.
I used to use Van Winkle Rye in my Manhattans at home.
Yeah.
It's absurd.
And now, like, I don't know, they on the secondary market, they go for more than 1,000 or something ridiculous.
I thought they were, like, at 800, but they didn't release it last year.
Either way, it's more than I can afford.
It's absurd.
I had cases of Blanton's and Weller 12 sitting in my house.
Which is, it's just, I used to help people that couldn't, in other parts of the country, that couldn't find Weller 12, even just a few years ago. I used to find it to them and send it to them at cost, just because... Why not?
You can't get it in some states, yeah.
There's a restaurateur that shall remain nameless. That
does it rhyme with Dorgan Feber?
No. It's not in our group. I think it's more of a chain.
Okay.
But he lives here in Houston, and I've known him for quite some time.
Oh. And I know what it is.
No, it's not who you think. I guarantee it. So,
it doesn't rhyme with Kappas?
No. But anyway, this fellow he's the owner and CEO of the whole thing, and he and I were catching up one time having lunch, and you know he's a big Pappy Van Winkle fan, and we caught up again at a Pappy Van Winkle dinner that I was hosting at the Palm, and so he and I started talking, and he was lamenting like everybody else how hard it is to get, and of course I recommended to him, well you really should try the Weller 12. And this was right before that craze started also, which was, our
creature. Weller 12 is a craze?
Creature of our own making.
Now it is.
So this, and I had caught wind that it was going to start become allocated, and I warned him. I go, well, you might want to stock up.
And he bought
I thought maybe he meant like two or three bottles. He bought 26 cases.
Good God.
26. This was
old style
this
bottle,
was 4
yeah.
years ago. This is 4 years ago,
oh, with
yeah.
the with the, was that the ago. Raised wheat? Was What was it, 5?
I don't know. I don't remember that.
I think 5 years ago would still make it the raised wheat.
Yeah.
He sent me a picture of it, and I was like, dude, that's not what I meant.
Yeah. In that case, you should stock up on Pierre Ferrand stuff.
Right. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
I'm saying, man, 30 cases don't later. Stock up on stuff. There's always going to be good stuff out there. Secretly, I'm saying that because I don't want to have to hustle to find a damn bottle.
Yeah.
I mean, we've all, at least in the, depending on where you are in the hobby, if you're 2 years in, when you first start, you may have 6 bottles to your name. And then when you get into this hobby full blown, there's plenty of us sitting on 500 plus bottles on accident. Like, you're not meaning to, you're not meaning to do
which
that.
Which itself is a sickness. Like, I look at, I'm in my house and I, you know, my girlfriend gives me justifiably a hard time because I have bottles all over the house. Too many.
Like, you have dogs too, right?
I have a dog. Actually named her after Rosie, Four Roses whiskey, which I have. I think I have like 75 different single barrels of Four Roses, which is ludicrous. It's a nonsensical thing to do. Why would you do that? It's so stupid.
Because, you know,
fear of missing out.
I'll explain exactly to you why. Because it feels good. It's nice to look at your collection. Just kind of look at it.
It is.
You're not even drinking that night. You just go look at the bottles and go, that makes me happy.
It's but so
you're
stupid.
But you're also getting addicted to the idea of trying something new and tasting something different. So I think that's part of what the addiction is when I collect stuff. When I collect stuff, you can cut that out.
Checking
Chris,
his phone.
Chris Detmore's calling me. That's why I thought I turned the vibration off.
Why don't you take it and put it on speakerphone for the podcast? That'd be fine.
So you can leave that in. I don't give a shit. What was I saying? Once you get into the habit of finally start picking up stuff, even if you can't quite describe it, I think you get addicted to picking up something new and different. And, you know, even locally, we've done quite a few barrel picks, and we've covered the gamut of barrel-aged spirits. We just did a plantation barrel pick, which should be here in the fall. We did something locally, MB Rollin, who it's not your typical profile bourbon, so it might turn a lot of people off, but it's something so different that when we went up there to visit, you know, me, Wade, and Randy, and my wife, Bob Gardner, and Alan, and we tasted through their barrels, and we just enjoyed picking out the differences. Yeah. And so it may not be your thing, sure, but for me at this point in my adventure, it's more about trying something new and different as much as possible.
Yeah.
And I couldn't encourage people to do it more. And then, of course, you end up piling up 300, 400 bottles on accident. So.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Whiskey debt is a real thing, guys, but that's on a different episode. So you covered dosage élevage. What's the difference? What is that?
Well, because as I said before, élevage is, as we said, it's just simply the steps you are taking to make the best product from production to bottle. So dosage is part of our élevage. There's another, and I screw up this word all the time, redouage. It's the practice of we will restave barrels if we feel that the cognac is not maturing as we want it to.
Right.
So we will literally take cognac out of the barrel, remove a few staves. It could be three, it could be four. Add different staves.
To reinvigorate the barrel.
And then put the cognac back in. It's a lot of work. There's another process that we do. So we don't bottle our cognac at barrel proof. It's just not the spirit that we want to do. So like any producer that wants it to get to a bottling proof, they're going to have to water it down. And I know watering it down is such a negative term, but that's literally what you're doing.
Right, cutting it, yeah.
Right, you're cutting it, right. So we don't do it all in one batch. It's not like we batch the barrels and then add the water to it to get it to bottling proof. That's going to shock the spirit. We like to do a gradual process, and it's called patito. Small water. And we're actually taking water and aging it inside cognac barrels. And then we'll take the cognac out of a barrel and add some of the petito to it and put it back in the barrel. So we're gradually getting it down to bottling proof. We will eventually get to a point where it's a relatively low proof, and then put it in the blending vat, and then add some more water to that, and now it's ready for bottling. So it's a lot of steps.
It's a very labor-intensive process.
Absolutely.
It's not what you would just figure that you just, like you said, pour it into a tote, add a bunch of water to it, and it's a little bit more complicated than that.
You could sell your barrel-aged baby water. Probably make some money on that from
suckers.
It's like that Kentucky limestone water that people buy.
You drinking tonight? No, I'm just having water. We got a new market there.
that whole Kentucky limestone thing is a big pain point of mine. It's frustrating, the whole idea. I think there's just a vast amount of misinformation or misunderstandings of what comes with spirits like plantation, the dosage process, or Kentucky limestone water, enough that you could literally bottle it and sell it for more. You think typical bottled water is a bit overpriced and absurd if you realize what you're really paying for. And then you throw the bourbon craze into it, and you're selling Kentucky limestone water. It's insane. It's craziness.
People like to buy stuff, man. The other thing is, I think people, and quite frankly, us included, assume that we can taste more than we can. So Wade just put on a blind tasting of 20 different American whiskeys, and there were some.
A third round?
So this is the second one that he did. And, you know, you're tasting a spirit completely blind. You have no idea what type of whiskey it even is, other than the fact that it was made in America. And there were some that I got wrong. And I mean, I drink spirits all the time, and I like to think that I know to some degree what I'm tasting. But there was one bourbon that I thought was a rye or something, and I was totally embarrassed by. And so the idea that you would buy this Kentucky limestone water and somehow it's going to affect the flavor positively compared to your tap water, as long as it doesn't taste like sulfur, is ludicrous.
Right.
I'm not familiar with this trend. What's going on?
Dude, people are... I mean, it's been going on for a while. Like, I think Weller did it
Weller actually
decades
put it
ago.
In their squat bottles. So there's a trend. I don't know if you'd call it a trend necessarily, but some Kentucky bourbon distilleries are selling their limestone water as, like, you know, use this to cut your bourbon with, because of the whole fable behind limestone water. And for those who aren't familiar with it, a big selling point for Kentucky whiskey is that it's limestone water natural. The limestone in the ground naturally filters out a lot of impurities in the water, which is right.
And removes iron in particular, which is
correct.
Detrimental.
But
yeah, you don't want iron.
Yeah, but that happens, period, with any filtration. So, and you can reverse osmosis as well. And what a lot of people don't realize is most bourbon produced in Kentucky is made using tap water. Yeah. Brown-Forman, Heaven Hill, all of their products, they use reverse osmosis tap water, not typical,
but,
like, natural.
This is the same as people buying, you know, bottled water for regular consumption and not realizing that it's just filtered municipal water.
Right.
Yeah, I mean, people...
Spring water.
Yeah.
That's the way to go.
Yeah.
So it's just a weird trend that happens. But I want to get to the Renegade Barrel. So what's...
Sure.
Different about this one, because I thoroughly enjoyed the first one.
Well, I think in order to describe the difference, we should start with the first one. Renegade Barrel number one was something that we released last year. That was our Pierre Franc Cognac, and we went a little extreme on it. We aged it for an entire year, an extra year in the Sauternes cask. And just gave it a completely different flavor profile. We bottled at a relatively high proof for cognac, at 96 proof. And it was just a unique little beast, like we were talking about earlier. This one is the Renegade Barrel number two, the same cognac that's been, this time instead of the Sauternes cask, we're using chestnut casks. But this is the hang up on this one, is that we cannot legally call this one cognac on the label. The rule, the law being that it has to be aged in oak to be called cognac, and this is chestnut, obviously not an oak. So on the label, it reads Pierre Franc Eau de Vie de Vin. And on the back, it'll say made with Pierre Franc Cognac.
That pronunciation was delightful.
Thank you. It just kind of bounced around right off the tongue, right? It's a completely different taste. And I'm going to be perfectly honest. When I tried it for the first time, I did not fall in love like I did with the Renegade Barrel number one at first, but then I let it sit for a minute and I revisited it, and then I did, you know. But
kind of, it reminds me of a bourbon, but I'm a specific note I pick up on a bourbon, but I can't quite tie it together.
It reminds me of like a weird antique chest of drawers that my parents had in there.
So I'm glad you said that, because the one that I said before was that the Renegade Barrel number one is the single malt drinker's cognac. This is your bourbon drinker's cognac, as I go so far to say.
Not to say that if you drink malt or bourbon, you can't drink other things, but...
No, yeah, but this is going to appeal to the person that has that trained palate, you know, or I should say...
This is fascinating. And the moment you said your grandmother's drawers, or what was it?
I did not say my grandmother's drawers.
Wait a minute. No. I'm going to need six copies of that.
Delete this. No.
I don't mean.
It reminds me of an antique piece of furniture.
Sorry, I meant.
I was on antique.
I meant specifically like Chester. What's it called?
Chester drawers.
Chester drawers.
Chest of drawers.
Not grandmother's drawers.
No. Those smelled like laundry detergent. Well, that's
no, but good. The moment you said that, that's all I could think about was those old timey antique furniture. That is, what's the proof on that? Is it the same proof?
It's going to be 94 proof.
Let's see here. 350 liter oak barrel. It's just one barrel, right? So it's not like a... Am I understanding that? First matured in a C, and then...
No, there's going to be more than one barrel. It's not a single barrel, no. We will be batching 40, it before we bottle it.
47.1.
That's interesting, man. There's a lot of dried fruit.
There's a lot of dried fruit. A lot of Christmas flavors in there. Mm-hmm. Oh, I see.
It is a limited release. We're going to get a little bit more... No, I can't remember. It might be about the same we got last year. I think 100 cases we're going to get.
Gorgeous label. Same. Every time I look at these,
just so I want to tell you about the Zebra. You mentioned the Zebra. The Zebra's on the first bottle as well. Eli Ferrand the Eighth. He was... the Ferrand... You have to understand, the Ferrand... Pierre Ferrand, the label, has only been around since like 1989, right? The Ferrand family has been producing cognac for over 300 years. It started obviously with Eli Ferrand the First, made it all the way up to Eli Ferrand the Tenth, and unfortunately, he died without an heir. He died in World War I without producing an heir. So, pardon me. But Eli Ferrand the Eighth was really the man who really put the Ferrand name on the cognac map. He was very instrumental in convincing the rest of the producers to, during the phylloxera epidemic, to use the North American roots to solve the problem. We have a lot of documentation of him being very involved with the owners of the Hennessy family and Remy and Martel. They used to kind of congregate. You know, before there was an AOC, there was this, if you would, the five families, if you will, of cognac that got together and meet. And he was very much so involved with them. But he was an influential man, and like most rich influential men, he was also a bit eccentric. And he collected rare and exotic animals.
As one does.
We're talking ostriches and that sort of thing, and giraffes. But at one point, he tried to bring a zebra in from Africa to train it to pull his cart, his carriage, right? And, people tell me, you can't do that. He's like, don't tell me what I can't do. He's like, no, you don't understand.
Mostly the zebra's telling him he can't do that.
Exactly. Yeah, it's a wild animal. It's untrainable. We can't train it that way. But,
they can't be domesticated, right? If I remember that from school, biology,
nothing with stripes can be domesticated. Yeah.
So to that point, when we first went to the AOC and said, we want to do a cognac and age it in sauterne, I said, you can't do that. We found out we could. We put a little zebra on there and said, don't tell us what we can't do.
So wait, but what happened to the zebra? I want to know the rest of the story.
It killed him and his family. They all died in a horrible zebra accident.
The zebra murdered everyone.
As one does.
He's still out there in France, just waiting for his moment for revenge. Now, I'm sure he kept it and just with the zoo. Just he couldn't, he was not going to pull the carriage. He sure kept it with the rest of the animals.
Yeah. Sure. Just leave him be. Does what he does.
And do their thing.
So we are fastly running out of time. A little bit of a tongue-numbing sensation there. So when will this be here?
Soon.
In Texas, at least.
Soon. This year.
All right.
I
know how that works, because in the sense that we've had several, literally every barrel pick we've ever done has been late.
Everything is always late.
Yeah, especially in the alcohol world. So I get it. So if we're slated for, let's say, August, we'll see it in December.
I'll give you some phone numbers to the purchasing department at Republic, and you can ask them yourself.
And push them. Yeah, let me know what division you're in.
The longer this sits in the glass, the more that kind of that chestnut wood comes out. If that's what I think I'm smelling, I have no idea.
I hate to say the word nutty, but I'm thoroughly enjoying it.
Yeah. This will make a good highball. Yeah. It's got a certain richness to it that. Because, when I think about drinking this, I'm very seasonally specific about what I drink. Like, I can't drink Manhattans during daylight savings time, for example. But I can't drink super rich brandies or whiskeys when it's hot outside. But mm-hmm. this would make a just neat. But this would make a super refreshing, I think. Like, there's enough richness that you could lengthen it with some bubbles. And just like people tell us, because a lot of times, some of our more expensive stuff, people tell you can't make cocktails with it. Mm-hmm. This is my zebra.
It tastes really good out of the bottle on the train from Cognac to Paris also. I can testify to that.
Okay. Well, I can't thank you guys enough. Pasha, I've said this. I actually wrote this down. When I grow up, I want to be like Pasha.
You need more gray hair, dude.
I would trade gray hair for – I would keep the gray hair if I could just keep my hair. But that being said, I highly recommend you, for those listening, to get outside your comfort zone. If you're in the Houston area, you need to go visit places like Arrow Flint and Rosewater and Clear Lake. there's several bars in Houston that just make phenomenal have a phenomenal selection outside of just your whiskey realm. And if you need recommendations, I highly encourage you to join.
Bad News is another place that has a terrific diversity of spirits on their back bar.
Bad News Bar.
Yeah, Bad News Bar.
I'll say that my favorite part of this is simply sitting around trying something new and talking, just talking with good people. So that's what it's always been about, is doing that. So
it's fun stuff, man.
Thank you guys so much for
thank
coming.
You. Thank you.
Appreciate it a lot.
Absolutely.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Life is a workout, and Smoothie King is here to help you power through. Whether you're grinding out bicep curls, or muscling the couch across the living room, crushing morning miles, or sprinting through back-to-back meetings, Smoothie King has fuel to help you maximize your workouts, own your recovery, and elevate your game. Give your body the energy, protein, and power it needs with a lineup of delicious smoothies made to help you conquer your goals. Only at Smoothie King.